Okay, let's get going. Another beautiful day in paradise. The teams. I hope all the teams are working diligently on their projects and are making progress every week. And if you can share some of that progress with me, that would be great. By email, would be fine. And if you get stuck on anything, have a question about anything, please let me know, and I'll do my best to get things squared away and get you connected with whatever you need. No handouts today, but we will. The slides will be on the class website later on. And so the item for discussion today is, are people with phobias considered disabled? And what about if the fear of flying prevents an individual like John Madden from working in his chosen profession? And is John Madden's bus then considered a job accommodation, which is a term used to describe a device that facilitates an individual working in an employed position? Are things like fear of heights, do you think that's a disabling condition?
Yes, if you're a window washer.
Okay, that's good. You know, depending on what you're doing, you know, if you work on the first floor, it's not going to be an issue. But if you have to work high up, then there may be a problem. But there's actually been a lot of discussion about this, and I don't think there's been a determination whether or not the ADA considers phobias a disabling condition, especially things like kleptomania and other things like that. But so it's sort of an interesting item to think about. Anybody else have any thoughts about this? Okay. Next Tuesday, we're going to have Professor Jessica Rose from the Lucy Packard Children's Hospital, and she's going to be talking about gait analysis. So next week is all going to be about gait and walking, because a week from today, we're going to have a colleague talk about crutches. So it ought to be very interesting. She runs the gait lab over at Children's Hospital, and so I'm sure she'll be talking about that as well. But today we're lucky to have Dr. Jenny Corrale. How old is that picture, do you think? I don't think you changed that much. Jenny has been a colleague of mine at the VA for many years, and she's the director of clinical research in the spinal cord injury center over there. 20 years experience in conducting research with individuals with spinal cord injury and on a broad spectrum of clinical topics, including osteoporosis, cardiovascular risk, telemedicine, nutrition, and upper extremity function. And specific to this talk today, she's serves on the Stanford Institutional Review Board for the Protection of Human Subjects in Research, and has been doing that for 8 years. And she also serves on the VA-wide Institutional Review Board. And that panel's responsibility is to pioneer the process of oversight on multi-center projects across the VA. Dr. Corrale has an appointment as clinical assistant professor in the Stanford Department of Orthopedic Surgery and is affiliated with the new Stanford Program for Spinal Cord Injury Repair, currently under development in the Stanford Institute for Neuroinnovation and Translational Neuroscience. Jenny's talk today will be Human Subjects and Research, so please welcome Jenny Corrale. Okay. No, we're recording.
Oh, okay. Okay. And is it clicker?
Right here.
All right.
That's right. And here's a laser pointer.
Okay. Hi. So as Dave says, I've been involved in research for more than 20 years, and the majority of my, well, all my own research has been with people with spinal cord injury. So I have had, I have a very wide exposure to that population. I've served on these various, so I've been a researcher in the trenches, I've been a reviewer as an IRB member. Any research that takes place here or at the VA goes through the Stanford IRB, and it is Institutional Review Board, not Investigational Research something or other. Like a lot of people get it all confused. It doesn't actually matter. It's the panel that looks out for protection of human subjects. I have a lot of slides because it's a very involved and complex process, but I'm going to go quickly through a lot of them because I want to sort of show you the complexity and try to get it down to the important things. So I won't actually apologize for the slides. It's just that's why there's so much. So I'd actually like to just hear a little bit about you all, your thoughts. Why do people choose to participate in research? Do people have any thoughts? No subjects?
Because it's a way of getting involved in what could be cutting edge science or a way of just finding out about new material, new technology.
Okay, that's definitely. Can people hear? I don't have to repeat things. It's a small enough room. Okay. Getting involved in innovative research, exposed to new technology, that sort of thing. Okay.
I'd be compensated by money.
Compensation? Should that be? How much money should that be? How should the compensation be determined?
Well, I've done some psych experiments, and everybody just gets compensated the same amount.
True. Yeah, you get compensated for participating. It doesn't matter. Well, the data will always be useful, but you get compensated a certain amount for participating. There's actually that is actually often a major topic conversation in IRB panels is the amount of compensation, but there's no specific rules about it. Who else?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say.
Same thing. How many people think it's a motivating factor is compensation? Okay, it's because you're students.
Yeah.
You've all been in psychology students. How much did you have the, when you were presented with projects, especially through psychology, did you have, how was it presented? The opportunity, were you supposed to do it as part of extra credit? Yeah.
Sometimes they can make it sound like actually doing the study will be fun. Like,
uh-huh. So it sounded like fun, so that's an additional bit of a reason. Okay.
My undergrad, if you take a psychology course, they make you do research studies for the psychology department.
In some psychology programs, they make you do participation, which is patently not the way it should be, as a matter of fact. I was so concerned the first time I heard that, but I'm not...
Well, you get to, like, choose which one you do and everything, but then you do
okay. That makes it a little bit better, but it's still voluntariness is a very interesting term because even for you as students, I think participation in voluntary activities is kind of required. You won't get into medical school if you don't have a whole lot of voluntary experience. I mean, it's very interesting how this word has changed its meaning from way back when I was in college.
You know, it occurred to me that some people might choose to participate in a research study because the study may help them with a medical condition that they have.
That is a reason, a perceived reason for participating in research. We'll get to that. We did not talk before. What do you think the responsibilities of researchers are towards human subjects who have chosen to participate in their studies? Any thoughts on the responsibility of the person who's conducting the study? Yeah. Okay, state the risks. Okay, that's good. What? Shh. Somebody else? There's a lot of people in this room.
Just disclose anything that might be relevant to the effects of the, like whether they're risks or benefits or whatever it is.
Okay.
Any effects of being participating in the study.
Disclose as much information as you can about the study. Okay? Other kinds of things? How about safety? Should be as responsible, the principal investigator, PI, is, and everybody related, should be responsible for safety, for, there's quite a few things, and I'm sort of going to, I was trying to just get some thoughts, and I'll go through quite a bit. Anybody else? Thoughts on responsibilities? Okay. And I participate, my world has always been medical research. So, and I am not a physician. I have a PhD, and I have always worked alongside and in partnership, whenever possible, with physicians. I am not a treating clinician myself, and I've actually always chosen to make it very clear that I am distinct from the treating clinician. And I think some of that may come out as I'm talking, why I feel that's very important, and the process feels it's important as well. Okay, some things don't come through, like there's some color and font changes, but that's okay. I sent these over at the last minute, so some of it may not be absolutely perfect. But so I think that I believe very strongly that the credo for clinical research is that it is a privilege, not a right. Not every clinical researcher gets to do research, and especially where humans are involved. And this actually cuts across quite a bit. We have so much regulatory oversight these days in any kind of research, certainly in human research. It's in the news all the time. You know, there's so many examples that I think a lot of people who, and clinicians particularly, but, you know, advanced academics who enter academic environments feel that it's their job to do research, that's good, but especially when you're dealing with humans, you have to take lots and lots of things into account. It isn't just something you get to do because you want to. That's a poor motivating factor. So a couple of examples of things I want you to sort of think about in the interplay of people participating in research and people conducting the research. I will say that my role on the IRB panels on which I've served is I usually take as much as possible the subject's point of view. That's been something that's been very important to me because, as I said, I'm not a treating clinician. I deal directly with the people. I have done the vast majority of my own explaining of studies, obtaining consent, dealing with the people myself. So this is actually something I feel very strongly about. Physician may approach a patient and say, and all of this would be perfectly okay, I want you to consider being part of the new study, it's looking at a drug, may help you with bladder control, you should not feel obligated to participate, I can't guarantee any benefit. There's a long litany, you'll hear later, things you have to say. You may experience discomfort during the procedures, there may be some risk of this, that, and the other. The patient hears, I have to do this, the doctor has ordered it, I have to. Study coordinator may say, I want you to consider part of a new study, is looking at drugs may help you with your post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm talking to you as a participable research participant. You're a veteran. You've been in combat. You may be experiencing some PTSD. You should not feel obligated to participate in any way. Research is always a choice. These are opportunities for us to learn things that may help you in the future. They want me to be a guinea pig. And the neurosurgeon research may say, this is actually, these are examples of real studies, but a neurosurgeon I work with is looking at a research study to look at how the body responds after a spinal cord injury, an incomplete injury. There may be some recovery. He's explaining to the patients, we'll be making measurements of your brain to see what happens when you think about moving your arm or your hand. This is not a treatment study. We may learn important information that can help us in the future. And especially because this particular study, which is a real study, is dealing with new patients with new injury, this research may cure me. In my initial interactions with patients with new spinal cord injury when I was doing my dissertation research, I had no exposure to any of this. I taught myself. I was thrown in without any orientation, anything. I was looking at changes in the skeleton after early acute injury. And I was faced with people, they heard research, young guys just broke their neck in the hospital first couple of weeks and months, and research cure, research they're going to fix my spinal cord injury. And I had to go over and above explaining that I was looking at changes in the skeleton that were of interest, might lead to fractures later, maybe we could reverse them if we understood them better, but I had to go out of my way to make it clear I was not working on a cure for spinal cord injury. So hope. People participate in research. They want treatment. They want hope. And hope is an important thing. So, the overview of the talk, I'm going to spend time on the principles and the regulations governing human research, because these are many and they're complex and they're important. I have a lot of detail in the slides since they will be printed. You can go there for a summary of the even more complex regulations. I will not be going over them chapter and verse. I'll talk a little bit about the process of the institutional review, especially here, and responsible as a clinical researcher, and sort of interrupt me if you have questions. So a very brief history. I'm not going to go into this in any detail. The reason I want to bring it up is I think that the dates and events are kind of important. This is a brief overview. Going back as far as the 4th century, there was an ancient standard of medicine which included things like do no harm from Hippocrates and maintain as confidential that which is told to them, which is really pretty interesting. The confidentiality dates back so long. I would have thought that it was extremely recent because, believe me, it's in all our regulations, and it seems as if it's become the most important protection issue of all. In 1947, the Nuremberg Code came in. I mean, this history actually is rich and fascinating and sad to think of what has been done in people over time, that all these rules had to be put in place. But the Nuremberg Code came in because of the Nazi atrocities, things that the physicians and other people in Nazi Germany were doing to people in the name of science and medicine. And the Nuremberg Code was the first sort of codified set of rules that governed how you should treat people involved in research. And interestingly, the first principle was informed consent of the people is absolutely essential. 1947. 1966, the Surgeon General of the U.S. Had a memo requiring institutions who were getting federal funding to establish institutional review boards. To tell you the truth, I don't know the regulations that described the institutional review boards, because the rules that we follow now came later. In 1974, so what's that, 8 years later, the Code of Federal Regulations came into being, and this is a very dense document that has all this detail of the things that we do now. So that came in 1974, and in 1978, the Belmont Report was published, and this is actually a wonderful document. It's extremely readable. I will send the URL, I forgot, a link to where you can find this document. We can find it anywhere. It's about 10 pages of extremely readable language that discusses all the issues related to participation of humans in research. And it is upon that that many, many things, the current system of the way IRB runs, everything is based on this, the cornerstone statement of ethical principles. And it actually is, as I said, very readable. In 81, another Code of Federal Regulation, CFR, came into being, and this is very similar to 45 CFR Part 46. It deals with clinical trials. In 1991, the Common Rule, which pulled together these various regulations. So this is, and it has a lot to do with good clinical practice. So the history is actually not so old of regulation about how to treat people who are involved in medical research. So the Belmont Report is really, sorry, I forgot this had the sound effects. It'll keep you awake. So to touch on a few things about the Belmont Report, it's very important. The commission that came up with it was directed to consider boundaries between medical, biomedical and behavioral research and the routine practice of medicine, so research and practice. And this continues to always, this is not always so easy to tell the difference. They were directed to consider risk-benefit relationships in research and appropriate guidelines for the selection of human subjects in such research and the nature and definition of informed consent. So informed consent, it's in there. It's very important. It's one of the early tenets. I hope these are quieter. I'm not sure. The boundaries between practice and research. This continues to confound people conducting clinical research. Practice commonly refers to practice, what's normal, standard clinical practice. It's not definable in too much more detail. It's what your practice is. It can be different from one institution to another, but it is the practice that reflects interventions or other kinds of dealings with people that is meant to enhance the well-being, to treat them for medical conditions, this sort of thing, with a reasonable expectation of success. Practice involves treatment, not research, actually. Research designates an activity designed to test a hypothesis, permit conclusions to be drawn, and develop information that can contribute to generalizable knowledge. Research is about research, answering questions. These can be related to treatment, but it's not the same as treatment. It's different than treatment. And this really continues to be an issue all the time. Practice and research can co-occur. They can be carried out together. And if so, the regulations apply. Anytime there's research involved, these regulations apply. I think I won't go into too much more detail because you all aren't, nobody's really involved in a clinical treatment study. It's more sort of devices and things related to assistive technology. I should have said earlier that my experience is with disability. I think there are some issues that I will mention that are perhaps distinct with regard to people with disabilities, but I did not design the talk in any way to address that because it's not that different. There'll be a couple, if people think of things you want to ask me something, particularly that occurs to you that might be related to with a person with a disability participating, please say so. But mostly it's kind of the same. They are us. They are the same. So the Belmont Report established the ethical principles and guidelines for human subjects protections, and their basic principles: respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. I actually used these kind of things as examples in the little star things. The respect for persons is how you interact with people, what you tell them, what they know. So the whole issue of a patient believing they have to do something because the doctor says so means that perhaps they haven't carefully explained what they should. Respect for persons, even if the doctor meant to be very respectful, the whole issue of differentiating research from practice might not have come through. Beneficence has to do with doing no harm, talking about risks, and justice has to do with equality. So my example of people thinking they're a guinea pig actually falls into this. So I'm going to go again quickly through these, but these are really important. These three guiding principles cover everything. So respect for persons. The moral requirements are that people should be treated as autonomous, always having their own ability to make decisions. And also, there is protection of people with diminished capacity and diminished ability to make autonomous decisions. Now, this crosses over into some kinds of disability, some mental disability, as far as decision-making capability. There are a whole set of regulations to help protect people who cannot make decisions as readily themselves but can still be either looked after by somebody else, or there can be a series of changes you make in the whole process so that they understand, so that you reach them at their level. People who have diminished mental capacity as well as decisional capacity, which is not always the same thing.
And children,
which I'm not really discussing. It's a good point. Diminished autonomy could include children. Thank you. Children are specially protected. There's lots of extra code or federal regulations and levels of protection for children because they can't speak for themselves. And even we have to do something I'm sure you've all heard of and seen consent forms. There's something special for children called an assent form that is put at language that they can understand so that they get to read it and have an input. And they can say no, even if their parents are saying yes. If the child says no, the child can say no. And this is all built into the process. I actually think that something closer to an assent form should be used in place of a consent form. So the way that this comes into play, the application of respect for persons, has to do with the whole process of informed consent. It's delivery of information, making sure there's comprehension of everything you've told them as best as you can, and voluntariness. Assuring it as much as you can, because it's all based on people should be voluntary. The principle of beneficence, the general rules that relate to this guiding principle are do no harm. But, in fact, do no harm is a fundamental principle of medicine. It actually isn't do no harm. It's minimize harm as much as possible. You can't always guarantee that you aren't going to do harm, especially accidentally, and there are risks. So it's not perfectly do no harm. Medical treatment isn't do no harm. That dates back to an early idea, and it's what guides people, but it's not quite the same. You don't intentionally harm anybody. Maximizing possible benefits and minimizing possible harms, and avoiding harm requires learning what is harmful. So there's a whole required section of the consenting process about risks, and some of it, we even have to include statements about things that may be unforeseeable. We can't guarantee you won't have something happen that wasn't foreseeable in what we know now. So these are built in, and the system is meant to do its best to inform and protect. So the application of this whole idea of beneficence is a risk-benefit assessment. You know, how are the risks compared to the benefits? How does that work out? And this is an example. Folks were just not doing this right. Risks, benefits. Probably this would not make it through an IRB. Risk versus benefits. Risk is an interesting term. It's the possibility that harm may occur. It's the chance and the severity. So it's not that simple. You don't just say you may have some headaches, you may have some leg spasms. You have to explain everything that may come from the more common to the less common, the less severe, most severe. I've seen a number of studies about exercise that list death as one of the possible outcomes. I mean, some people die during exercise, so it's sort of interesting to see what people choose to put out there as risk. And it can include physical, psychological, legal, social, economic harm, this whole slew of things. It also gets to the perception. This gets, perhaps, into the different patient populations. Some people with disability, there may be certain kinds of risks that are different. Risk of losing an economic access to economics. We actually have people who I've known of who participate in research studies. If you make a certain amount of money by participating in studies, it has to be reported to the IRS. And if you make more than a certain amount, it may affect disability claims. So there's so many levels of things that can be risks. It becomes a very individualized thing, and I think it's important to realize that the rules are in place, sort of broadly stated with lots of examples, and it's important to always think about it in the context. Benefit is something of positive value related to health and welfare. It is usually not expressed with probability. It's just something that's out there because that's what the study is looking at. However, you have to be very careful when you're talking to somebody, not talk too much about all the benefits they'll get. As Dave's example, you do not talk about the treatment effects they're going to get by participating in a study, because that is not an outcome of a study. It is something that determines whether it's okay to involve people in human research, but it is really very much less about what benefits they'll get out of it. You have to be very cautious. If this isn't making sense, please ask me. But it's a fine dance sometimes about what benefits they're going to get by their participation as opposed to the benefits of the research to understand a problem better, work towards a better cure or treatment or something like that. But it's distinct because a benefit would come from a treatment, from something in clinical practice. So I think I've already said this. Risk versus benefit is something that you have to balance as you're moving forward. Surprisingly enough, this is in the range of acceptable risk. Depending on how important the project, the problem is that you're addressing, cancer, the risks to patients on cancer treatment are huge. There are horrible things that happen, that will happen, to patients enrolling in a cancer study, taking new cancer drugs. They are awful. But the benefit of possibly reducing the effects of their cancer are great enough that these large, awful things are still within the balance. Justice. Justice is the third principle. The general rules have to do with fairness in the distribution of burdens and benefits. And if you go into the history of where human subjects protections comes from, this is actually probably one of the things that comes out the most. Have people heard of the Tuskegee study? Anybody know Tuskegee? Okay. First example, black men with syphilis were enrolled in a study that actually, it's really interesting when you read back, the people conducting it were really not the monsters they probably come out to be thought to be. They were studying something at the time it started. There really were no known treatments. However, treatments came along. People weren't informed. A lot of things were done that were very wrong and probably wouldn't have been done that way if it was a population from Beverly Hills involved in the same study. So the issue of fairness has to do with who are the people involved, what are the burdens. Prisoners, there's many protections for enrolling prisoners in any kind of research for the same reason. You know, you can't pick a population and offer them one type of research opportunities and a different population and offer them a different one where the sort of well-to-do people are getting the good stuff and the poor disadvantaged people and the people with disabilities and who knows what, this group of people are not getting these opportunities. So that's where the concept of fairness comes in. So there are many examples of this. And so justice actually becomes very important. We even have to look at research studies and see are they including people of different ethnic backgrounds, women and men. The rules do not say you have to include everyone, but the rules say you have to consider where you are not, and you have to justify in a way that makes sense for the issues you're studying. So it is not saying everybody has to be included. It's just be just about how things are offered. Actually, today I was on a call to Washington for the Central Library. We were considering some protocols, and several of the sites had said they were going to be, well, everybody said it was going to be doing English only. Well, some of the sites are in heavily Hispanic areas. And so the question came up, you know, should they be offering this study with Spanish translation, with, you know, non-English only as a restriction? In this case, that was not something that overrode what they were doing. We did not tell them they had to, but we brought it to their attention. Are they you know, offering something different because they are restricting the language as one of the enrollment pieces? So there's lots and lots of ways this comes to be. Protection of vulnerable populations is yet another thing that is handled in these codes, and it is defined in 45 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 46, as including children, prisoners, pregnant women, handicapped, mentally disabled persons, economically or educationally disadvantaged persons. In my experience on the IRB, handicapped is not in the list of people we have to protect. All these others are sort of categories we have to protect. This is still in the code, but it is not commonly part of how we consider things. I guess in a lot of ways, as someone who works in the area of disability, I don't consider somebody with a handicap or disability all by themselves vulnerable because of that thing. You know, I think that it has a lot to do with judgment and respect. So, but there are added protections looking at competency for consent, potential for coercion, which is undue influence when you're trying to convince somebody to be in your study, and people may be excluded from participating if they're in a vulnerable population, if it's in their better interest. So the IRB review process is, I'm going to go very quickly through these. I just, as I said before, I sort of want you to see what it involves, but it's a review process that is based on these rules. There are regulations about the membership of the people reviewing, so it includes scientists and non-scientists. A clergy person is meant to be, is usually included, members from the community, legal representation, as diverse an ethnic group as you can get. So there's actually rules about the board that reviews human subjects research. The review of the protocol involves everything. They have to justify the human subjects. There's a whole system of reporting adverse events when things happen, when people are hurt, when they show side effects, that sort of thing. And then there's an oversight of periodic review. The approval criteria are you have to make sure risks are minimized. You have to show that the risks, any risks that there are reasonable in relation to these anticipated benefits. The selection of subjects is equitable. Informed consent is sought and that it's documented. And actually, that's an issue. I'll talk about it a little bit later. There's additional rules about monitoring the data to ensure the safety of the human subjects as well as the integrity of the data. There can be additional provisions to protect privacy and maintain confidentiality, and that has become the watch terms of current research, especially in the federal government. And again, as I said a moment ago, vulnerable patient, people who may be vulnerable to undue influence or coercion, there's added safeguards that you really have to discuss and justify. So the confidentiality issue, I will not be going into in a lot of detail. As a researcher, as a reviewer, there are times that this is exactly how I feel. I can't make a statement to the press that would violate the confidential relationship between the researcher and his guinea pigs. It has sort of gotten to the point that you don't know what you can say because somebody's concerned about it. However, having said that, because that is how it feels, being on both sides, as a researcher and a reviewer, I've also come to find that the rules for confidentiality, which is protection of information, and perhaps in many ways privacy, which is how the person is handled. Privacy is, do you talk to a subject in the hallway where everybody can see, or do you invite them into a closed room where it's private? If they don't feel like talking about it with anybody else, it's private. So confidentiality is the security of the information. And in this information age where there's social security numbers all over the internet and patients' medical information everywhere, there are many people who are very concerned about their confidentiality and also any information about themselves being on the airwaves. Same time as lots of people are putting it out there. But these have actually, this has become huge. So I kind of want to bring it up because as you're dealing with people, you know, you're going to be talking to people out in the open. You have to be a little cautious what you say to your roommates when you're dealing with human subjects in a research setting. If you go home and you're sort of chatting away with your research with your roommates, and you say, oh, I had this interesting guy I was doing a study on. He has this and this and this, and he had this interesting condition. And you have to consider respect for the person. It's not to say you have to have a gag and cannot talk about interesting things that you're doing. Be respectful. Think about his confidentiality or hers. Think about what you want somebody saying these things about you. And these are probably not new concepts. But since you're dealing with humans in the context of research, think about these things. And you are covered by anybody you work with, as you're involved with these people, to treat everything with them confidentially. So informed consent. What is this? How is it accomplished? Does it need to be documented? And how do you know that the information has been conveyed? That has been conveyed, has been understood. So I actually want to get a little bit of audience participation again. What's informed consent? What does it mean? Somebody who hasn't said anything. Who's heard of informed consent? Who has seen an informed consent form? Okay. Has anyone, how many people have participated in psychology research or any kind of research study? You all have seen consent forms because you must have signed them. I hope so. Did you read them? Aha. Did somebody explain to you what the study was about? Those of you who have participated in studies, did you understand what you were getting involved in? Did anybody not?
Yes.
Okay. Very important. Informed consent is there is a process, and the regulations, these other ones I've talked about, coming from the Belmont Report, 45 CFR 46, 21 CFR 50, 61 and 60 and whatever, they require informed consent, that informed consent is obtained. That's what it says. That means you talk to people, you explain what you're asking them to do. They, with autonomy and voluntariness, agree. They consent to do these things you have asked them to do. That is an informed consent. They understand. You have made them understand as best as you can, and based on that understanding, they have consented, agreed to participate. That is informed consent. That's what it's meant to be. How is it accomplished? Dave and I go way back, and there was a time when I first dealt with him that he was involved in a study, and I walked into a room, and he was sitting with a subject, he was sitting next to the subject who was being enrolled, and he was reading the informed consent, word for word, and these are now 15 and more page documents, even for a simple measurement study, and he was reading every word. And I sort of came in and said, what are you doing? And the process of informing somebody so that they can consent is a conversation. It is something that you do. You talk to them about it, whatever it takes. That's how it should be accomplished. There's actually getting to be rules about, or guidelines, about how you should accomplish this. There are suggestions of ways to post-test, you know, ask people back. Did you understand what I was saying? Could you tell me what the study was about? What does it sound to you like I'll be doing? You know, do you know how many study visits there'll be? There's sort of suggestions now of ways to see how informed the person is. Not everybody subscribes to that yet, but that's coming to be part of the process because it's come to be understood that not everybody understands what they consented to do. So how it's accomplished is actually very important. And when you're someone who deals with human subjects, it's on you to explain it. If you're working on a study and you're dealing with people, you should always answer that question. Explain why this device is going to do the thing it's going to do or what you think it will do. Or answer questions as best you can. If you don't know, get someone else to explain it. But it's accomplished. Obtaining a consent from somebody is accomplished by an interaction. Does it need to be documented? Well, actually, no. That is not part of all the rules. The rules do offer regulations about its documentation. So the easiest thing is it's supposed to be documented. We have this informed consent form. And there's signature lines, and then there's people who sign that they saw somebody sign, and then there's date and time. Actually, time. We even had discussed in this call today. And it goes on and on. That is not the thing. That is the thing that documents that all the rest of this happened and that they were given the form and that the form represents, as best as they figure, the conversations that happened. And people should read the form. But the signature is not the important thing. And there actually are ways you can waive signature. Yeah?
I was just going to ask, once you sign, is it legally binding?
It is not. It's a really good question. Thank you. It's not a legally binding document. It is simply an indication that you have been told. Usually there's a statement that says, I've been told this, you know, the things contained here. It's not supposed to say, and I understand. Because that's not, you're not supposed to say that. It documents that you've been told, given this information, and that you agree to participate. Throughout the discussion, throughout my interaction with people, throughout the consent form itself, there are places where it says, you can withdraw at any time. So it's not legally binding. It is the documentation that you were present. You know, it would be, it shouldn't be something that happens that you would then come back to sue the researcher because you said you didn't understand the study, because this document should be part of that. But you could say, you know, they talked to me, but they used big words, and I didn't understand it. And they kind of rush me through this, which is what many people do. They say, oh, trust me, I'm explaining the study here. Sign this. You know, you can read it later. So it's not legally binding.
So what is legally binding? I mean, what protects the researchers then from being sued?
Well, this process is not about protecting the researchers. This process is about protection of human subjects. It has gotten turned inside out. Stanford, as an institution, does a great job in trying to protect the institution. It's heavily thought of as a document about liability of the institution, but that is not in the Belmont Report. It's not in the Code of Federal Regulations. It's not in there. And the hope is that people are properly educated and do the process right, and that the documents actually do say all those things, and the researchers have said all the things, so that the people participating shouldn't want to sue. But it is not. This process is not meant to protect the researcher. The other regulations are sort of in place to protect the researcher as much as possible, but not this process. This is about the humans, which is a really good point. Thank you for bringing it up. So then this last one, how do you know the information that's been conveyed has been understood? I pretty much said that, but it bears repeating. It's, you know, whether they understood what you were telling them. I don't know, how many are parents here? Probably not too many. Does your kid always understand everything you tell them? There's a difference between telling and understanding. So it really bears thinking about. So now I'm going to really go fast. The informed consent, there is all this detail of all the required things. So I'm just going to sort of read the headings. These are the required elements that reflect back to all the stuff I've been saying. You have to say that it involves research. You know, you sort of figure, like, gosh, what do they think they're doing? But anyway, there has to be a statement that says research. A description of the reasonably foreseeable risks and discomforts, as I said. This stuff you can read later. It's the detail-y stuff, but I've pretty much been saying it all along. Description of any benefits. These are all the required pieces. And at Stanford, there's pretty definite required language we're supposed to use that is sort of been looked at by the lawyers. There is a lawyer present at the IRB meetings to make sure that a lot of this stuff happens the way he thinks it should. Actually, it's a woman now. Disclosure of alternative procedures. I didn't mention that. That's very important, and that's part of the voluntariness, and it helps prevent undue coercion. You might say, this is a great study. You should see it's going to measure all these things. It's going to help. It's a treatment. We're going to find out, blah, blah, blah. You have to say, oh, but there are some other things that could do the same thing. So they really know what they're picking. So alternative procedures, alternative treatments available are really important. And you often have to say your alternative to participating is to not participate. Because, again, this is research on top of clinical treatment. So maybe they're not getting a treatment. Maybe there is no alternative to that thing. So then the alternative, they don't have to participate. So this business of voluntariness keeps coming up, and it really is all through the consent form, and it's because it's really important. Statement about confidentiality, for research involving more than minimal risk, explanation about compensation, liability, what happens if you're hurt? There's a whole paragraph about if you're hurt as a participant in this research, this is what you'll get. You can come into the hospital, you'll get these things. I will tell you it's not very clear, but it's in there. Some more things, who to contact, specific names and numbers. Kind of funny. Most people take the consent form and drop it in the trash on their way out, so it's not a document that they will use. So our studies, we usually give them a card that has contact information, but these are required to be given. A statement that participation is voluntary, and various specific things relating to, this is all required, all these things that are in greenish-yellow. I have to say they're not going to lose any benefits, their medical care is the same, this is in the context of a medical study. Additional things you may have to say, treatment or procedure may impose risks that are currently unforeseeable. Anticipated circumstances, why an investigator might terminate the participation, additional costs, reasons that they may withdraw, statement about significant findings. We have to say that if there's any new findings that come up that may influence whether you still want to be in this study, we have to tell you. For some reason, we have to tell them the actual number of subjects. I guess that gives an idea of, you know, if a whole lot of people are being enrolled or just a handful, you have some sense. That's actually a requirement. So this is how I feel often. I find it hard and harder to get any work done with all the ethicists hanging around, both as a researcher and as a panel member, because I have to keep up with all the rules. Are human subjects adequately protected? Despite these regulations, there are many things that are not mandated and reviewed. You know, awareness and acceptance of the ethical principles. These ethicists are out there making determinations, trying to protect people. The guidelines are there. The regulatory people are there. But it's got to be the researchers and the research staff who are aware of these ethical principles, underlying ethical principles. You don't do things because the research requires it. You think of the people first. I mean, these principles have to be at the center of everybody, and they should be applied by the individual researchers. Voluntariness is so important. It really is part of everything. You know, how you approach people is important. There can be excessive and inappropriate external forces. How you approach somebody, the difference between coercion and manipulation versus persuasion. You know, if you're a physician, you can manipulate people. I have known of clinicians who enrolled people in their studies, and the people would be in the study with me, or people I'd know, and they did not like how that was handled. So it's something that I hammer on all the time, because I think it's so important. I've had people, students who come work with me who, we have really benign studies, measurement studies. We measure activity. We measure subjective health. Can they go approach a guy in a wheelchair in the mall and say, oh, we're doing this neat study? You know, can't do that. You can't just run up to somebody. There are all sorts of rules about how you engage people. Another thing to think about, which gets back to one of the questions I asked earlier, was intentionality and motivation. This is back to why do people participate. Intentionality is autonomous decisions. Same thing, voluntary. You know, making decisions based on their values, their goals, why they want to do something, they're intending to participate. Motivation, willingness and motivation, I think are important things to consider as you're enrolling people. Altruism, you know, they want to do something good for the greater benefit. They think about why they're in volunteering, think about what they're trying to get out of it. This has to always be in the minds of the people participating in research. I think if you're doing device development, you know, it's really cool to talk to people. You want to engage them as much as possible. You have to be careful what you're promising. But you definitely can involve them because they may contribute a lot of information to you. I think I've pretty much gone through recruiting and obtaining consent, just some things that really does matter, who obtains the consent, who has a relationship, who can explain the study the best, non-coercive, you know, who's the best person to do it, and what circumstances. You don't walk into a patient room and sort of go talk to the guy in the first bed about a very delicate study. You know, there's a lot of things to the whole process, and these, again, are regulated. I think I've made a reference to subject selection. There's just details about eligibility and suitability. I think this is the only one that I think it's important to think about, perhaps, when you're enrolling people. Will they be honest with the researchers about any kind of things that are happening, that they're not participating, they're not taking their drugs, they have some adverse event? Some people are afraid to speak up. They think that they won't get paid. The physician may not continue giving them medical care if they were sort of bad, you know, research subjects. So as you're thinking about people who are being enrolled, you have to think sometimes about their mental state and what they understand of the study, because even these kind of components of human behavior play in. Are they telling you what, you know, device development is an example. Are they telling you what they think you want to hear? You know, how are they reacting? So just those are sort of more subtle things to think about. Understanding comprehension, I think I went through this. One thing that is important is the consent form has gone way beyond what it should have. It is now 15, 16 pages for a simple study, 25 pages for a study with greater risk that has more complicated procedures. And I go to an annual human subjects conference. It probably sounds dry. It's actually not. It's incredibly motivating. And the people who speak there about the issues it's an unbelievable conference, and it keeps me doing these things because it reminds me why it's necessary. Everybody knows the consent form has just gone way beyond anything that helps anybody understand anything. So we're trying to come up with ways of having a much simpler consent form, and that's why I just go over and over the importance of talking to people. The consent form, this full information, every last detail of every last risk down to the finest percentage is just... It's overload. People don't even know what they're involved in anymore. The process has gotten in the way of what it should be. back to medical practice versus clinical research. Many parallels, but they're not identical. I think these things I've sort of covered. Motivation for participation, altruism and idealism are kind of important things that motivate people, not personal benefit. It's a choice versus voluntariness. Likelihood of effect is unknown and unknowable about the research. These are some of the things that characterize research different than actual clinical practice. And I think one of, I forget if this is the very last, let me see, moral responsibilities of the investigator, which I started with, that I want to finish with, is these things are mandated by the federal regulations, and they're guided by ethical principles. But, you know, these are things that that researchers should always do. They should respect the human subject's ability to choose. They should respect the human subject in every way. They should not give undue influence or coercion. Provision of complete information, at the level of comprehension. I didn't say that before. There's actually rules that say it should be at least no greater than an eighth grade reading level. You know, we try to make these consent forms as simple as possible, which in medical research gets hard because some of the things are just involve bigger words. But when you really set your mind to it, you can usually explain things in smaller words. And so I think that's important. The level of comprehension is important, and that helps them understand and consent. Equitable treatment, as I said, absence of conflict of interest. One last piece, which is really important in Silicon Valley, at Stanford, with engineering, conflict of interest can actually play into a lot of things where an investigator has a lot invested in the thing he or she is studying and doesn't really disclose to the subject that they're going to make a whole lot of money if this device is successful or if the results go a certain way. So there's also protections about that there should be no conflict of interest on the part of the researcher in what they're doing that would unduly influence the way the risks are dispensed. So that is a whirlwind tour of a lot of things that confound a lot of people, and I didn't want to overwhelm you. I wanted to show you how broad it was and how much is involved, but it's actually a process that makes a lot of sense and is based on all the right things, and I think people should embrace it. A lot of people who are involved in research, the thing that they fear and hate the most is going through IRB, and it's really not so bad if you understand why you should do it, and especially if you have somebody who knows the process helping you. So I'll stop, and I'm open to comments, thoughts, questions, anything.
I should mention that I have a human consent form for the class for you to deal with the people in the community that you're working with on the projects. But the question for Jenny is, where is the line where you need to administer the human consent form? Is it when you start talking to somebody? Is it when you start talking to several people? Is it when you start writing down comments? Is it when you touch them?
Well, it's defined by the research. When someone is engaged to participate in a research study, so first this is condensed into a tiny amount of time. First you have to, it has to be research. It has to be research that involves human subjects, and then it requires a consent form, and it is required at the very first moment that they agree to participate. You can talk to them without them signing a consent form. You can describe it. It gets a little tricky once you start writing down information. If you write down name and phone number, all by itself, that is not participation. But there are IRB regulations. When it is an actual research project, so I want to be careful. We can talk about it a little bit, and I'm not going to be the regulator overseer. But when you start writing down personal information, this is regulated, and there's something called HIPAA, which I haven't even touched on, which goes in parallel, and that's the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act. That is all about privacy, and it goes on and on. It's a whole other talk in and of itself. But if I am engaged in a research study and I have a flyer that has been approved by the IRB, and people call me, and I talk to them about the study and start writing their name down, I have to read them all sorts of things, the eight required elements. I have to tell them all these things. And all they're doing is they have voluntarily called me, and they're going to give me their name and their phone number of their own volition. But the rules now say I have to do these various things. However, I can ask for a waiver of consent at that point. So it's a long-winded answer, but in my world, I don't need a consent form signed yet, but I have gotten the IRB to waive the documentation of consent for that process. So their involvement has started. But the IRB has waived the rule that they have to have signed first. It's really complicated. It's kind of silly.
Another thing I should say is that there's training on all these topics available on the Stanford website, and I've got links to them on the course website. So for when I was at the VA and here actually too, I have to have that MRI yearly, but you can go through that as well and see how get a much more detailed view of how the stuff works.
Yeah.
In your experience, does the review board have to step in very often to stop the researcher?
No, I've actually never seen that happen. I haven't seen it. I've never seen that. I think that, in my experience, I think that I've had the luck to work personally with ethical people. I think the review board does its best, well, different panels I'm on, do their best to review all the material presented and think about what the study may look like. It's really infrequent that a study has to be stopped because of misconduct. I guess it's a good question, and if this were my field of study, I would be better armed with sort of occurrences when that actually happens. Interestingly, it happens sometimes because of perception, not because of actual misconduct. There's been a huge problem for the VA in recent time that about a study that has come to be called the Shantrack study. And in my, I don't know every last detail, but it was a study about smoking cessation, and it offered a couple of opportunities for smoking cessation treatment programs. Part of standard practice was a drug called Shantrax. That's not quite right. And it has some side effects, but it's part of clinical practice. And it wasn't part of the study. It was something that many of the patients were getting because they were in smoking cessation programs, but it wasn't part of the research study. If I remember correctly, it can lead to depression, and I think this is the study where there was a suicide by someone who was enrolled in the study. So the VA came under huge fire for this study, putting patients at risk. And it became a huge problem because the perception, the study was stopped, of course, the perception that this drug was used improperly in patients and the risks weren't in the consent form and weren't part of everything under the sun. But that was part of clinical practice. It wasn't part of the study. The perception that it was has added one more layer to the things we have to do. So we have to, as a review panel, we have to really differentiate practice and research. And we now usually do require that anything, even if it is clinical treatment, but if it is happening in patients who are receiving this kind of clinical treatment are enrolled in this study getting these research things, you address the clinical treatment things as well for this sort of liability issue to cover the institutions. And so the perception can often be as bad or worse than real misconduct. But I think it is rare that studies have to be stopped. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to ask kind of back on the original question. What if you just, like, if you're observing people and using it, not maybe directly talking about what they're doing, but you're observing people and using your notes in order to do something else with that information, does that require the consent, or some sort of...
And it will be confidential. No names will be taken, things like that. I don't think so. I think that there are part of the IRB process, I mean, as much as I told you, there are things I left out, too. There is a lot. There are things that can be exempt from human subjects review if they don't really include human subjects, and I think that one of the categories includes observations made on group of people doing normal behaviors, because you're not engaging with them, you're not interacting with them. I neglected to put that there actually are definitions of involvement with human subjects. So there are obviously touching and doing treatments and involvements, but even interactions, you know, engaging with people, giving them surveys to fill out, things like that. For the most part, observations of behavior, especially in a public setting where they're doing the normal things they were going to do anyway, where there's no kind of intervention, you haven't had them do something. You didn't have a bunch of children go play on blue play structure and another bunch play on red play structure and see if they do things differently. Oh, sorry, that's my phone telling me it's time to think about going home. But I would say most probably that any kind of observation of normal behavior would not require it. I'll make sure that you have the direction to the website, because there are categories that make it real clear. So is everybody working with somebody, or are people sort of doing their own thing without any kind of supervisor?
Many people who are working on teams on projects.
Okay. And I'll be happy to include my my email, because there's and I don't mind answering some questions like that, because some of the things that I don't have direct involvement with, that kind of thing, I don't remember every last detail, because I am not an administrator, I'm a reviewer, and when I'm in a panel doing reviews, we have all sorts of materials in front of us, and I can always check exactly what the regulation is if I have to. But I think that, you know, common sense leads a lot of things too, and I think that the rules are in place for all the right reasons, but they aren't meant to hinder student projects that are not putting anybody at risk, that are not being disrespectful. I mean, there's a lot of things that I think these rules may not have to come into play in the things that you're doing. And I would be happy to give an opinion on things that you're wondering about. So I probably want to know a little bit more detail, but you know, don't have to necessarily use up all the time right now.
Jenny, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.